Hello, and welcome to Tech Access Weekly, a podcast of unspecified length concerning news and events in accessible technology. It's January 1st, 2010, episode 19, The X Factor. And Happy New Year, everyone. Some might say the end of a decade. Others might say the beginning of a decade.
You start from zero.
Everyone else says you start from one, but a few of us. My mother even heard a radio announcer spend a half an hour yesterday talking about whether it was zero or one.
Non-tech people call it one. Tech people, because of programming, call it zero.
Okay, whatever. I don't really care. The point of this podcast is to do a decade end review of where we are now versus where we were in 2000. To that end, we're going to discuss all or a good many of the technology developments and happenings during that time. And what we've discovered is that where assistive technology comes in, it has to run and scramble to keep up with the mainstream. So where the way this is going to go is we're going to talk about mainstream developments and how assistive technology has ran and scrambled to keep up with it.
Should be an interesting discussion.
Thus, the X factor.
Yes.
To the development of assistive technology is the development of mainstream.
That, and it also seemed like everything this year revolved around the phrase the X factor.
Yes, so yes.
We thought we would try that.
Let's start off by talking about something very basic that a lot of people may not remember much about, Y2K.
Yeah, the Y2K crisis came out in 2000, go figure, when the turn of the century, going into four-digit dates in mainframe programming especially, a lot of the old code from the 60s and 70s and 80s only dealt with two digits. So everything was going to revert back to 00. Which would mean sorts would be out of sync. Programs wouldn't know exactly what to do when calculating a date. So a lot of programmers, including myself, had to go through a process of changing code in order to make the dates four digits instead of two.
So how did you do that?
A lot of coding required that you actually just specify that it's a 1999-2000, that way it falls into place, as opposed to 99-00, because a lot of old code and systems out there thought that 00 was 1900.
Right. So, I mean, I heard this hype in the media. The world's going to end. All computers are going to come crashing to a screeching halt. You will no longer be able to use your computer after Y2K. So what actually happened? Much of anything? Were people prepared, or, I mean, how do you, what's your take on that?
Well, some computers, older computers, had issues. I mean, computers that were developed, that were built just in the mid 90s would have problems because motherboards, would not know how to handle the new date. So there were a lot of patches and things that people had to load on their computers in order to update the BIOS settings for how to handle the clock. So that was one thing. So I was working in financials where we worked on a mainframe system, which was IBM's AS400 systems. And we had to go into the old COBOL RPG programming languages and actually expand the date fields to include that expanded date. And I know a couple of instances we had issues where files that were created did not actually sort correctly. So, I mean, there were some minor little issues going on, but I remember when New Year's came that a lot of the TV stations around our area had reporters standing out at ATMs and they were doing ATM transactions saying, it still works.
Exactly. But what they didn't realize is somebody who was ahead of the game and had put in that patch already so that it would work.
Yeah, and that's what a lot of it was. I didn't really hear that much about issues. I think a lot of companies probably started making modifications probably 2-3 years ahead of time just to prepare for it.
Right. Moving on, the whole decade was just a proliferation of developments, starting, of course, with the rate of information exchange. I mean, like, that's sort of like a sociological term, but all of a sudden, so much information became available to us so quickly, through the internet, principally, and through Google. Google became a household word.
Well, that
in a matter of months.
That and the internet was just 10 years old, really.
Yeah, really.
With the 90s, you had like Gopher and Telnet systems and just text only browsing. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, like 94, it started popping into actual web pages.
Yahoo came out in the late 90s, I guess, probably.
Yeah, and then you had search engines like Lycos, mm-hmm. AltaVista, Yahoo, of course. There was no Google, which is basically now a household word.
You used to say, I'll search for it on the internet. Now you just say, I'll Google it.
Well, that and the internet was considered the information superhighway.
Yes.
Or the World Wide Web. Mm-hmm. And now you don't even hear those terms used anymore. It's just the internet,
mm-hmm.
or search it or Google it, mm-hmm. something like that. But Google didn't really come around till 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And they've just turned into such a advertising powerhouse with Google Voice.
Their AdSense campaign.
AdSense, search engine optimization,
mm-hmm.
The sort of Google Wave project that was released this year.
We really don't know what that is.
No, and everybody sort of wanted a invite because you couldn't get an open invitation to it,
mm-hmm.
without someone actually sending you one. And once everybody got into it, it's, mm-hmm. sort of, what do I do with it now? With the internet, we had the development of RSS,
mm-hmm.
by Dave Weiner, really simple syndication, which allowed for news and information to be easily passed. A lot of people used news readers. Google Reader was, mm-hmm. one of them. Mm-hmm. What did you use? Blog lines?
Well, the thing with a lot of RSS readers is that they're very, some of them are very inaccessible. I guess really simple syndication, it kind of follows that, you know, you want really simple interaction. And a lot of them are very point and click oriented. And so when we as blind people were starting to have difficulty interacting with these websites with content that was frequently updated, like RSS content, blogs were, there were online services that would help. And that is basically what I started out with, was a cloud-based RSS reader. And I find myself going back to it even now, 5 years later. The one I used was called Blog Lines. The pages were a bit cluttered, but they had a lot less clutter than some other sites. And you just basically stored your feeds in the cloud, as the saying goes, on the internet, on a website, and you could go back and read them at your leisure and see when they updated. Now they've integrated RSS readers into email clients, which I think is fantastic. Thunderbird, for instance, you have the ability, Mozilla Thunderbird, to get your feeds that way. And Windows Live Mail, you can get your feeds that way also. That's how I've started doing it.
Looks basically like a email,
yeah,
message.
But I have often found myself going back to blog lines for certain links that are in feeds, that are in posts. If I want to go to a link in a post, sometimes with the email clients, it won't let you do that. Or if you want to link to the post, the link won't show up in the message that you get. So I find myself going to the website or back to blog lines just to get that information.
And then RSS also led to what we're doing, which is podcasting.
Yes.
Where people basically create their own content and, mm-hmm. pass it around. Some people consider, say, Adam Curry to be the podfather, because I guess he started first, like in 2004, and then, mm-hmm. there's been debates as to whether, like, Leo Laporte, who started in 2004, 2005 with the Twit Network,
mm-hmm.
And then it basically grew from there with people wanting to create information and distribute it. It's just continuing to grow and grow and grow to the point that now, instead of just having audio feeds, a lot of people are doing video.
And this is all amateur. I mean, a great part of it, I mean, other than, you know, Dave Weiner and Adam Curry and Leo Laporte and all those people who do it professionally, a lot of it's amateur people doing vlogs and podcasts, almost like journalism.
Yeah, a lot of it is journalists that no longer have a job or want to supplement their income by trying to get mm-hmm. advertisers and distribute their information.
Mm-hmm. So this is leading to all this information is so freely available and being distributed by so many different people. This is kind of leading to the downfall of the print newspaper.
Yeah, basically, Craigslist has killed newspaper revenues all by itself just because newspapers would get information, get money from personal ads mm-hmm. and sales and service advertisements and things. And Craigslist is doing it for free.
Right.
They charge for some services that they do, but for the most part, you can go out and sell something right on the internet, post an ad.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of newspapers in the last couple of years have been decreasing their circulation. I believe two or three sort of second tier newspapers this year, like the Seattle Times or Rocky Mountain Times, one of those actually killed themselves and went to online only mm-hmm. distribution. So that's kind of a big direction that we're slowly starting to go in. Plus magazines like PC World and PC Magazine, I believe they're only online
now. And there are magazines in the blind community as well that have done that. There's a magazine that's been around for a long time called the Matilda Ziegler Magazine for the Blind, and it was a subscription magazine, pay and they'd send it to you in a, you know, hard copy form. It's completely online now. It's online, it's got a blog, it has a Twitter account, and all of its syndication is done online. There are a lot of other periodicals like,
I think the Braille Monitor, the Braille Forum
are online. You can get hard copies, but I get them online through email and podcast even.
And then you have also the invention known as Wikipedia.
Ooh, and that's even more information at your fingertips.
Granted, you don't exactly know what you can trust.
No, but it marks the trend from the development of the internet from, you know, specifically a place for, you know, personal individual action to growing towards a community-centered philosophy. Wikipedia has the ability for multiple people to edit information that is on the website. So not only can one person write an article about something, but other people can contribute to that article.
The only part about that that I just don't quite understand is you have people that have pages based on them.
Mm-hmm.
But the person that is actually being discussed can't edit their own information.
Yeah, I don't quite get that either. I'm not certain. But in the majority of cases, if you're just talking about words or phrases or something, most people can edit and submit new information. I think it's vetted a lot of times through, you know, people who try and make sure it's as accurate as possible. But you're right. I mean, what can you and can't you trust? I use it as a kind of, if I want just basic information, if I want more complex answers to a question, it's not really the place to go. But it is a good starting point.
Well, and a lot of college universities actually ban the use of Wikipedia for research papers, which is kind of interesting.
Hmm, that is interesting. It's interesting, but I can see why they would. Still, you can use Wikipedia to find bibliographical information for research papers. I don't see how they could prevent you from doing that.
I guess they wanted, this was like a discussion back probably 3 or 4 years ago where university professors did not want students to use Wikipedia. I guess it was just their base of information. Mm-hmm. You know, don't go to Wikipedia and just grab that information. Mm-hmm. If you're going to use it, you have to cite it a certain way or mm-hmm. go somewhere else and actually get valid information because
right.
nothing on Wikipedia is really truly documented as being a verified source. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
But when we're talking about amateur information, you definitely have to include YouTube into that.
Yeah, this is marking again the trend of the internet towards a community. YouTube started a few years ago. You were able to try and upload video of yourself, of things you watched on television. Gosh, the possibilities are endless there.
I mean, it starts with just being something for people to post things like you might see on in the U.S., we have America's Funniest Home Videos that started back in the 80s.
Mm, God.
And it's still on the TV.
I know. But they're not home videos anymore.
No, it's more staged stuff. Yeah. And YouTube has sort of taken over that space with their content, I guess, sort of a lot of kids using cell phone videos and things like that, or actual podcasts that people are doing in video is actually being posted now.
Right. And I don't think it's that difficult to post something. I've never tried. It's the website itself is a bit inaccessible. It's better than it used to be, a lot better.
Well, it's all Flash.
There are sites that are supposed to make the YouTube experience more accessible, but they really don't do a whole lot. And there's really not a whole lot you can do. I mean, if you can find the button, go ahead and play it. There are programs that people have found to rip the audio from the YouTube videos because the argument's made, well, we don't really need the video. We just need the audio. So, you know, for a time, a lot of people were using things like free YouTube to MP3 converter to rip the audio from the YouTube, from the website.
And now I believe there's even Mozilla Firefox plugins that will automatically do it.
Oh, that's interesting.
I haven't tried any of them, but I have noticed that they are out there.
That is something we really didn't talk about. The web browsers have become more widespread and more complex.
Definitely. But in the same voice as like YouTube, that sort of led to the idea of television on the internet. Hulu came out a couple years ago for, I guess it was NBC and FX and a couple other networks wanted to have their information out on the web so that users could view the episodes of previously aired shows. And that's become more and more popular as we go, which also creates the debate of new media versus old media,
right,
which is constantly going on. People that produce, write, and create the TV shows aren't sure how they're actually getting compensated for that information, which led to the strike that we had back in, I guess it was 2007, 2008?
Something like that.
So that's a big development. And now a lot of networks are developing their own websites. CBS, ABC, NBC, they all have their own portal for viewing their content. But Hulu also has a ton of different channels out there so that you can view it. A lot of it's in the style sort of like YouTube.
Right, right. And there's also, I mean, dare we forget, more community things like VoIP and social networking too.
Definitely. The development of Mark Zuckerberg's college-only project that he had in 2000, which was Facebook.
And that just took off over the past several years. There were things like MySpace and MyTelespace out there. MyTelespace is like an over-the-telephone kind of network. And MySpace was, of course, and is an internet-based social networking where people can post, have their own web pages and post things about themselves and interact with other people. And both of those services are still around, but they've pretty much been eclipsed by Facebook and Twitter.
Well, MySpace is used more by the media, as far as like bands and musical groups and artistic people, than Facebook. You have a lot of media integration as far as widgets and things on their web pages, which a lot of people have kind of gone from MySpace to Facebook because of the usability on Facebook. Facebook really wasn't open to the public until, say, 2004, I believe it was. It was mostly started for Harvard University, and then they opened it up to other universities, and then it became a world phenomenon.
And it also, I mean, it does have its accessibility issues, but there are sites like Facebook Lite that came out towards the end of the year, and of course the mobile Facebook site for cell phones that are a little bit easier and more accessible to use. The downside is there are things you can't do on those sites that you can only do on the full site, but they are still pretty accessible and you can do the major things. Now, one sort of beef I guess everyone has with Facebook is an issue with all social networking is security. And Facebook has made privacy changes recently that have just confused a lot of people. But I don't think that's going to impact people's use of it. There is something about being able to interact with others that you don't know or that you may know only slightly over the internet that is fascinating to most everyone nowadays.
Well, it's a new way to have news groups and user groups, kind of like Yahoo groups or NewsNet, things like that, where people can join and that share an interest in a certain topic.
And you still have those over email, Yahoo groups and Google groups and things like that. But they've really been eclipsed by social networking sites and other ways in which, you know, people can get together, not only through that, but I mean, there's also Skype. We haven't even talked about that yet.
No, Skype was sort of out just before the beginning of 2000. I can't remember exactly when it started. But now it's kind of mainstream.
Right.
You actually see commercials on television occasionally for Skype. And then there are other voiceover internet protocol services out there. A lot of cable companies are actually offering internet phone, they call it. You know, it's quite a bit more expensive than Skype or Uvu or
Uvu?
I think one is Uma.
Oh, Uma, yeah.
Well, one is Uvu, which actually is a pretty good video conferencing system. It's a lot like Skype, but I believe you can do multiple video conferences at one time. So there's a lot of applications out there like that that have come and gone, but Skype remains constant.
And, of course, the blind community had to run and keep up with Skype, too. As it evolves and its interface evolves, there are constantly new accessibility problems that crop up. There are keyboard shortcuts, but they don't always work, especially in these newer versions. You kind of have to check each time you open Skype as to whether they're enabled or not. And it does make it a little unwieldy to use. But overall, as the versions have kind of gradually come out, accessibility has improved. The first versions, we couldn't hardly even use at all. And I never even began until a couple years ago because I just thought, well, why bother? Because I'd heard so many people say how inaccessible it was.
Well, and two, a big usage has increased just because of the internet speeds, the technology for internet. I mean, even up until like 98, 99, 2000, most people were still sitting on
dial-ups,
56K modems. So I know I didn't have a cable internet connection or a DSL connection until say 2002 or three. So once that happened, that sort of paved the way for, the YouTube and Hulu and
the information craze.
Yes, exactly.
Pretty much. So now that we talk about all this information we have, we need to talk about ways to store it, because that's always resolved. That's evolved too.
But wait, we forgot one important thing. We went this long without mentioning Twitter.
I mentioned it a little bit when we talked about Facebook. A little bit.
But we really didn't talk about Twitter, which yesterday you had an interesting experience with Twitter.
God, this is funny.
As far as friends,
yeah,
or followers, as they call them.
Well, with Twitter, it's like any social networking, and actually I think it was it got popular because of its very simple idea. What are you doing? Tell us in 140 characters or less. And I didn't start using it really, though, until I could get an application to use. So I didn't have to be on Twitter's website to use it, because that I find a little unwieldy. But there are so many applications out there now that Twitter has given access to its API so that people can develop these sorts of things for it. So although I'd had a Twitter account for a long time, I didn't start using it until this year. Well, Twitter will send you notifications every so often when you get new followers, if you have it set up that way. And I just don't really think a whole lot about who's following me unless they look like some kind of porn entity or some kind of spammer entity, and then I'll worry about it.
Porn?
Yeah, porn. Like, I've seen naked girls, and you know, in their profiles, they say
sexy stuff. Sally 1234.
Yeah, pretty much like that. Well, anyway, so yesterday I just happened to be looking at my list of followers, and I saw someone's name that looked familiar. I remember this person because I met him in France when I lived there from 96 to 97, and I knew him very slightly, but he left an impression on me, and I remembered him. And I just happened to be looking at my followers, and I saw this name, and I thought, that name, it's got to be him. French. The last name is unusual for a French last name. And I went into his profile and looked at his biography. And lo and behold, he lives in the same city that I lived in. He's blind. He has all the other qualifications of the person that I knew. And it's 13 years later. And I just found out that he's using Twitter. And I don't think he knows who I am. He's just following me because other people are following me because I looked and we follow some of the same people.
Yeah, I don't think I saw you as shocked as finding that yesterday.
That really freaked me out because, I mean, only on the internet could something like this happen and both be totally unaware of the other until one of you puts something together. You know, I just happened to look at the name and look at the followers list. If I hadn't done that, I wouldn't have known.
That's true. So you can come in contact with people from all over the world and communicate in so many different ways.
Yes, exactly. I've communicated on Skype with people from like Sweden and England, and it's all free now. You don't have to pay these horrendous international phone rates that you used to have to pay. It's just the amount of information that we have at our fingertips. I mean, it's amazing. As opposed to 9, 10 years ago.
It is truly amazing how far we're going and how quickly.
And it just keeps, I mean, you read all these social treatises and how it's just increasing exponentially. And Ray Kurzweil has written a lot about this too over the past few years. How information, the rate of information exchange is just poofing. You know, I have it in my head as a big mushroom cloud getting bigger and bigger. And the amounts of information we get are just thicker and thicker, and what are we going to do with it all?
Well, that's where hardware comes into play. And some of the developments over the past decade have been DVRs, digital video recorders like the TiVo. A lot of cable companies have their own little system for recording shows. It's pretty much killed off the VCRs that everyone was using back in the 80s and 90s because I believe the last VCR tape maker actually went out, closed their doors this past year.
Oh, my.
So that's kind of an interesting thing. Granted, I still know a few people that just recently purchased a VCR, of all things, to record their soap operas. But
oh, yes.
But I don't understand why, if they can use a DVR, why they don't just use it, because you can set things to record like a season pass, where it'll just record every time that particular show's on.
Yeah.
It's point and click, easily accessible. Granted, I don't believe any are accessible.
Not for us, they aren't.
Well, speak for yourself. Anyway.
Not for us blind people, they're not.
There you go.
Yeah, not for we're pretty much on the out as far as accessibility of DVRs. As far as I know, no cable company has created like talking menus for their DVRs. Now, I could be really wrong, but somehow something needs to be done to change that.
Yeah, if you could work the DVR, I probably wouldn't be necessary anymore.
No, pretty much. Yeah, that's pretty much true.
You've really gotten used to using the DVR
and oh, yeah.
Not having to think about, okay, when is Lost on?
I just don't know. I mean, my parents, they don't use one. So they're like, what time is that on? What channel is that on? I have no idea. Rodney just records it and we watch it.
Once you go digital recording, you don't go back.
You don't go back.
But,
precisely.
That also led to another development, which is storage space. The hard drives and solid state media has just exploded over the past decade. Used to be you would pay, I believe I paid like $250, $300 for a 1 gigabyte hard drive.
Oof.
In the mid to late 90s. And now you're able to get a terabyte hard drive for like $80 to go into your computer.
I bought a 750 gigabyte external drive. Was it last year or the year before?
I believe it was the year before.
The year before, and it was like $250. And now I probably could buy the same thing for like $60.
Actually, yes.
So it's just amazing how much cheaper things have gotten. Storage space, especially. We have a server on the floor in here. Poor thing, processor went out. We still haven't installed the processor. And one of the reasons is, in between not having the server and desperately needing more storage space, we bought a 4 terabyte NAS ready storage unit.
Yeah, it kind of defeated the purpose of having a server anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I got a good deal on the server way back when I got it from another work colleague.
Right.
But now it's kind of like, absolutely, I don't really see a need. There's no urgency to replacing it.
Right.
But even with storage space, you have the solid state things, the flash drives, thumb mm-hmm. drives, and things like that, that just in the early parts of this decade, people were excited to see 1 gigabyte in a flash drive, which when it came out was about $300, $400.
Well, with my first laptop, I received, I think it was with the laptop, an 8 megabyte flash drive, and that was in
2001.
I thought that was the bomb. I loved it.
It was amazing. And now mm-hmm. you can actually get thumb drives up to, I believe, 64 gigabytes, mm-hmm. which they're actually running about $200 now.
And not only that, but SD cards.
Yeah, SD cards.
SD cards, that's what I'm talking about. How they just came out and how much cheaper they're getting. And you can store, I mean, I think they have up to, they have 120 gig, 8 gig SD cards out yet?
I think they may be getting close to doing 64,
mm-hmm.
But mostly right now it's 32.
Right.
For storage in cell phones and things like that.
Mm-hmm. So that kind of leads us into other types of hardware that have been developed to deal with media, not just storage, but to play back the media. We have something basic. I mean, first we have, you know, an iPod that came out.
That came out in 2001, and mm-hmm. it was only a 4 gigabyte iPod, which I believe it might have even been around $400 back then.
Mm.
For 4 gigs, just a tiny little brick of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And now you can get up to a 64 gig,
mm-hmm.
I believe it is.
It took a long time for them to make iPods accessible, just in the past couple of years. I think the iPod Touch may have voice output now. The iPod Nano may be accessible. The problem with the iPod for a long time was that it just has little wheels, and you have to really pay attention to how the display shifts and changes. And it's only recently that Apple has begun to address that issue. Now, I know some blind people were using the iPods when they first came out, and it was basically they had to play a guessing game and really count the turns of the wheel. Yeah, count the clicks. I never had one because I never saw the need. But a lot of people, I mean, loved to carry music around with them, and that's what they had. Another way in which digital media has expanded is with books and devices to read books. Let's play a comment that we received from one of our listeners, Lynn Tatum, who has the Malin Slice of Life podcast, excellent podcast. And she called in our voicemail, to give us a comment of something that she wanted us to be sure to cover this episode.
I'll just restate here that I thought that, listening to cassettes then and listening to digital content now, especially with regard to the National Library Services, or service, rather, where we started, you know, I was just a few years ago, I was still, never mind a few years ago, it was 07 that I think they came out with the digital downloads, and 09 they came out with the player. So before I ramble on any longer, take care, have a wonderful new year, and keep on doing what you're doing. Bye.
So she makes a good point. Before we talk about the ebook, let's talk a little bit about the way in which blind people had access to books, period. We had tapes, old cassette tapes, 4-track tapes, had to have a special player. And I still have one, and I still, believe it or not, occasionally will use it. But in the late 90s, they came out with these CD things that had, I guess, navigation a little bit you could navigate through. It was a special player that the library service gave out. I never had one. But then, as everything has gotten smaller and smaller, like we said, and things have been able to be stored on smaller spaces, and everything's gone digital, they had to come up with some kind of a solution for that. So companies started to develop small appliances that were multi-purpose. They not only stored music, but they would store audio digital recordings too. Humanware was one of the first to come out with it in 2007. They came out with what's called a Victor Reader Stream. Makers also had previously come out with a little bit simpler devices like the Bookport and Book Courier that did the same thing. They took SD cards and you could store audio or text material on them. But the Victor Reader Stream, and closely followed by the BookSense and PlexTalk Pocket, I believe also does this, will play back digital material. And what the National Library Service is now doing, they are taking their analog recordings and slowly trying to convert them to digital. And they are making it a service where you can download the recordings onto your computer and put them onto your digital player. And they are, for certain people, providing their own version of a digital player to record, to play these books in audio. Now, normal, everyday, regular people have the ability to read books in print with e-readers now, too, like the Kindle.
The Kindle, the Nook, and various Sony Reader, I believe, mm-hmm. has one mm-hmm. also. And then what I'm figuring is 2010 is going to be the year of the e-reader.
Mm-hmm.
They've been around since 2003 or 4, but they never really took off. The Kindle is the first one that actually started gaining popularity to the point that this year, like we had mentioned in a previous episode, the Kindle actually has sold more
Kindle books
than print books for the first time.
And one thing I guess I should have mentioned before e-readers actually was Audible, because that is a way, and that just came in the past 5 or 6 years or so, in which people been able to download audio content to the computer.
Actually, it came out around the first of the decade.
Did it?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you know, you go to the library and get audiobooks. Well, now you can just download the audiobooks to your computer for a subscription fee. You get one or two a month.
And there were book clubs that you could join back in the 90s that would send you actual cassette tapes for mm-hmm. books. So you would get a box in the mail that would have like 20 cassette tapes, mm-hmm. and you would have to remember to carry those with you.
Right.
And Audible sort of got rid of that type of media.
Yeah. So that it's taking off by storm. And they have some accessibility issues with their software that actually plays the book on the computer. But a lot of these digital players, like I said, you can contact Audible just like you can contact the National Library Service, and they'll provide you with a key that you can insert on your player that will play the book for you.
And also new software like iTunes mm-hmm. that handles and manages media, they'll play the Audible books.
Mm-hmm.
Zune has software that will actually play all of the Audible books mm-hmm. so that you can actually do that on the computer. It might be a little easier to use, but it's not until recently that iTunes became accessible.
Exactly.
For screen readers like JAWS.
Mm-hmm. JAWS, System Access, and WindowEyes, they had to really work with Apple. It took a long time because Apple is so proprietary. I think for that reason, Mac users may have had a little better use of it than PC users did for a long time. But it's accessible. It's still really quirky, but I can still use it to download media. I don't use it to play media, but I could if I wanted to. I use it for my podcatcher now that it will actually work with the version of JAWS that I have to download podcasts. And that kind of leads us into talking about the Macintosh. And I signal the Mac and single it out here because, you know, we're going to talk about computers in a second and how small they've been getting. But I would like to single out the Macintosh because it wasn't until about 2004, 2005 that blind people could actually use the Macintosh with a margin of success. Apple is so proprietary in their software lockdown that there really, I don't think, to my knowledge, was ever a successful screen reader used with the Macintosh until Apple began shipping Macintosh with a built-in voiceover screen reader that they developed.
Well, I think the problem with Apple developing that was just the fact that market share was just so small. I mean, even at the end of the decade, Apple only has maybe a 10 or 12% market share compared to PCs running Windows.
Right, right. But, I mean, and it's come a long way since 2004, as one of our listeners pointed out to me over Twitter. But you can pretty much do anything with a Mac that with the voiceover screen reader that a PC user can do.
And this year they came out with an update to Leopard called Snow Leopard that actually, from what I understand, dramatically increased accessibility.
Yeah, it did. I'm not exactly sure what it did, like I said, but it did. It made some dramatic improvements.
Because we do not have a Mac.
No.
Yet.
Not yet. We're thinking about it. But we just now purchased all this podcasting equipment, so we might have to wait a while.
Yes. Mortgage a kidney.
Moving from storage, we've sort of gradually been moving into portable data, and computers themselves are getting more portable.
Definitely. And the concept of internet everywhere also plays into that. The fact that most people in the United States, probably 80-85% have a high-speed internet connection as opposed to the phone line, the 56K modems and things. So most people are on DSL or cable at this point. There are even satellite internet providers, which aren't tremendously reliable, but for people in rural areas that cannot get cable, it's a definite option for that. Plus, municipal areas are starting to offer Wi-Fi, wireless internet in cities.
And airports.
Cities, airports.
McDonald's.
McDonald's. It's crappy, but it's there.
It's there. Devices, computers are smaller. More and more are being built with wireless technology. Things are going wireless faster and faster.
Things are very portable.
So not only do you have laptops, but you have netbooks now, even smaller.
Which is a scary thing that people are actually clamoring for netbooks, which are only a 1.6 gigahertz processor. And it's sort of going backwards in a respect, because that's kind of what all of the computers were at the beginning of the decade.
But it's the portability.
Yeah, it's the portability.
It's the portability, and you can take so much with you. I mean, like I say, the rate of information increase is just, and people feel like they have to have more and more information with them constantly, and the ability to get at information faster and faster with them all the time.
Yeah, the only problem with netbooks is that one podcast I was listening to this week called them disposable computers, basically because they're going to be used at home or personally for someone that's going traveling or something, but they'll never be used in a business situation just because they're not constructed well enough.
Right.
They're sort of computers that aren't going to grow with you. They're just going to be whatever they can handle now, and then as soon as something else is developed that requires more power, you're going to have to get something else.
This is a complaint that not only applies to netbooks, but it applies to note takers too. Way back in the late 80s, early 90s, we started having the concept of note takers for the blind, little portable machines that you could use to take notes on. And I actually have one of the first ones I ever got, which is a Braille and Speak 640. And, you know, it spoke and you could write Braille into it and it had speech. It's crappy speech, but it's speech of a sort. And as the 90s grew, the note takers grew to the point where, you know, 2000 and beyond, they started becoming like laptops. They started having pretty much all the same capabilities. They use SD cards for memory storage. A lot of them have Braille Braille displays on the front where you can read Braille as well as hear the speech. They have wireless internet connectivity, the ability to play audio files and on, just like a laptop. The problem with the note taker is they're horrendously expensive for what you get. and there's not a whole lot of growing that they can do without you buying a new machine. They can update the firmware, but they can update the storage capacity. And there are a lot of other sort of hardware things that they can't update. You have to buy a whole new machine, spend thousands more dollars on these things. It's even worse for us, than for people who buy laptops or netbooks.
I think they cost, what, $2,500 is one of the cheaper ones?
Yeah, $2,500 is probably the absolute cheapest you could get. Maybe a little less than that. But, if you want any kind of a Braille display on your note taker, even without a Braille display, I think the cheapest one is like $2,000 and something. So I'm kind of wondering how long the market for note takers is going to last, because people are buying netbooks. Buy a Braille display. They're selling pretty well. Buy a netbook. Then if you grow out of your netbook, all you have to purchase is another netbook, and you won't need to purchase, spend the thousands of dollars again to purchase a Braille display because you've already got one.
But the only problem that creates is the problem that most people are having is the fact that they have too many devices that they're carrying around.
Exactly.
A lot of people have iPods, e-readers, netbooks, laptops.
Smartphones, which we haven't even talked about yet.
And GPS, we hadn't even mentioned yet.
Nope. So that is a problem people are facing. What do you do with all these devices? And there have been attempts to combine all these into one, like with a smartphone. The iPhone is a classic example, which is leading us into talking about smartphones. But the problem is...
drink.
Yeah. But the problem is you don't... one device can't do everything well. And I think that's what a lot of people are running into. They love the iPhone, but it can't do everything 100% well.
That's true. That is very true. And with smartphones becoming kind of the norm, as far as accessibility, software came out to do screen readers such as Mobile Speak,
Talks. And that's something that they've been coming out for the past several years. Some companies have phones that are out of the box accessible, like there's a couple of Nokia phones, but they're not really smartphones. In order to deal with smartphones, especially if, you've got internet plans on your phone now, you're browsing the internet on your phone, which just, you wouldn't have thought about it in 1999. To deal with that, they had to develop, screen readers for phones. And they're basically scaled down versions of things they use for computers. So you've got Talks and Mobile Speak are kind of two of the biggest ones. The iPhone, again, because Apple was so proprietary, didn't have accessible means of use until just recently when they came out with one that with VoiceOver kind of preloaded onto it. People really like it. I haven't tried it. I wouldn't know. But people like it. Also, the Android software that Google's making for their smartphone platform is coming out with voice guidance, too, I think, pretty soon.
I believe it's already built in.
Yeah, built into some of them.
If they'd only increase accessibility on their web pages,
yeah,
they'd be accomplishing something.
Yeah. But that's an area, again, in which developers for assistive technology are really struggling to keep up with the development of the smartphone, because they're getting more and more complicated. So they have to try and make their screen readers do more and more complex tasks.
Yeah, the cell phones have basically turned into little computers in your hand.
Mm-hmm.
They're just miniature versions of a netbook that you've got with you 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an amazing technology that, like you say, you wouldn't have thought of 10 years ago that this would even be possible to have internet or a note taker in your palm of your hand.
Mm-hmm.
Like that.
And I guess maybe the last thing we should talk about is GPSs. That concept never even occurred to me 10 years ago. We knew about the cell phone. We knew about computers. I never thought about mobile maps.
And it was always people doing their trips and things, having to grab a paper map.
Mm-hmm.
Or when Google came around, they've developed Google Maps.
MapQuest. But that still is getting directions off the computer, printing them out, and taking them with you.
Exactly.
A GPS is a whole other kettle of fish. relying on satellite data from up in space to take you around. And most of them are not accessible out of the box. Most of them aren't being made accessible. There are some GPS packages that were developed for note takers, so you can use it with your note taker. I think there are a couple that you can use with a cell phone. And there are a couple that I think are standalone units. There's something called the Trekker. But they've really only been recent developments, and they're very expensive.
I think that's the key to accessible technology, yeah, is the fact that everything is expensive.
Everything is expensive, but GPSs in particular are about 4 or 5 times the price if you want to get a good one.
And then you have to worry about how often is it updated, mm-hmm, how new is the data that you've got.
Yeah, is this GPS specialized for, does it take into account walking? Because most of us who are blind do a lot of walking, most of us, from place to place. So, you know, have to take that into account too. I suppose if we really wanted to, we could use one of those GPSs that are have been developed recently for golf courses.
Yeah, I mean, even the Garmins have pedestrian directions, mm-hmm, to sort of give you an idea of where you're going.
True.
The new Google phones, like the Droid and the Droid Aris,
mm-hmm,
they are starting to have Google Maps and GPS on the phone where you can actually look at the place from a street view, so, mm-hmm, that you actually know, okay, I am on this street corner and this, right, is what I should be seeing right now,
mm-hmm,
if you are able to see the video or pictures that it has. So, mm-hmm, I mean, GPSs are probably going to increase in popularity and technology over, yeah, the next few years.
One last thing I would like to talk about, a couple that are specifically blind-related pieces of hardware. And they don't really fit anywhere, but one of them kind of fits with smartphones. There is an increasing amount of information, as we've been saying before. And the problem that a lot of blind people have been having is our independence is increasing. We want to be as self-reliant as possible. How do we read bits of paper that may be lying around? And that's something that's been addressed, tried to be addressed with some scanning applications, some of which are even portable enough to be put onto a phone. Very expensive, but portable enough to be put on a phone, like the KNFB reader. But at present, it only works on certain mobile phones, and it's quite pricey, but it is very effective, I'm told, if you're using the phone's camera and translating what it reads, what it takes pictures of, into text. So, for example, you want to take a picture of a menu, and you can use that to do it with the phone's camera, and then it will read it into spoken text. One other thing that is increasing people's self-reliance a lot, something I really want, but it's like the good ones are $1,200 or so, and I can't afford that yet, a barcode scanner. So you could go into a grocery store and theoretically pick out your own groceries. It's got databases of products and prices already in it. You can download more updates from, you know, websites. And that is one other thing that's been developed over the past 10 years. And there aren't a lot of them out there yet, a lot of different models, but they are there.
Well, that may be something that comes into current models of cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
The Apple iPhone has a Google application that you can turn a box over, take the barcode, take a picture of it with the iPhone, and it'll go out and search Google to find all the best prices.
That's excellent.
A lot of stores have actually started banning this application because, mm-hmm, people are going into Best Buy and places like that and saying, oh, what about this?
Mm-hmm.
And they'll take a picture of it and say, well, I can go 5 minutes away and get it for,
right,
$10 cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are doing that. Even applications like Evernote are,
ooh,
working so that you can take a picture of something,
mm-hmm,
load it into Evernote, and it'll transcribe the information, mm-hmm, for you into information.
Not a tremendously accessible application, but
no,
it does have its uses of keeping track of things, Evernote.
So it's kind of like mainstream people are going to probably get something first,
mm-hmm,
and then it'll be adapted later.
And this is something we've always seen, but it doesn't help to curb our impatience for certain things.
No, but watching what happens in mainstream media is definitely an X factor for accessible technology as far as whether it's going to catch on in popularity with Oprah and those folks, kind of like e-readers.
Right.
And actually give you the opportunity to get it for yourself. Just like coming up in 2010, the Kindle is probably going to get menus that are readable. So that's a big development just because,
big plus.
Just because the Kindle has exploded in popularity. So
exactly. And that's why we feel that our podcast has can fill this niche of not only talking about what's involved going on in mainstream technology, but any developments in assistive tech that may be happening as a result. And even things in mainstream technology that may be accessible to blind people that people just haven't tried yet.
And you kind of have to watch what happens with Google and Twitter and Yahoo and Microsoft and all these other companies just to see what might be possible and on the horizon.
And that is something that we may talk about a little bit more as CES gets closer and closer to in upcoming episodes about things that may be going to happen in the next year, 2010.
Which CES comes up this week. Starts on Wednesday the 6th, I believe it is, 6th or 7th.
So we'll bring you another episode very shortly. Perhaps it will even be Monday.
But hopefully people have enjoyed the decade review and sort of ramblings that we went over.
Yes, lots of ramblings. I don't think I'll edit this too much. So I hope everyone enjoys it and can bear with our rambling. I know we didn't cover everything, but we hit a lot of the highlights.
And we were excited to actually get a voicemail and actually be able to play it within the podcast.
Yay!
There was no edit on that. We just clicked play. Biggest factor to getting computer input into the mixer and the audio feed was the fact that the mixer needed to be plugged into the same power outlet as the computer. Something with the grounding and electrical interference. So once I did that, the hum went away.
So on that note, we will sign off until next time. Thanks for listening. To contact the team for Tech Access Weekly, send an email to techaccessweekly@gmail.com. Or you may leave a voice message at 260-2-ASK-TAW, 260-227-5829. Please visit our website at techaccessweekly.com.